SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yura Damarang, hello, I'm your host Luana Grant and welcome to NITV Radio for this Friday, the 15th of March. Coming up on today's show, NITV Radio chats to Walbunja Elder Wally Stewart from the New South Wales Aboriginal Fishing Rights Group about the landmark class action filed against the state of New South Wales on behalf of New South Wales South Coast native title claim holders who have been prosecuted for exercising their cultural fishing practices. We also share part two of Black Medicine's episode with Darug man Dr. Josh Tobin, who chats with host Dr. Michaela Cooch. And we share a few stories from our NITV news team. All these stories and more coming up after the news wrap of the week.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
One of the most powerful First Nations organisations in the country, the Northern Land Council, has elected a new leader. Matthew Ryan has taken over the role of chairman from the late Dr. Bush Blanassi, who died in November after serving a record 4 terms. Mr. Ryan is an advocate for constitutional recognition and has called for a more inclusive, open-door approach for all members across the council's regions. He says his priorities include improvements to education, telecommunications and health services.
Look, we need to address a lot of issues that is really, really burning. You know, all communities, 7 regions. And look, please forgive us. We're not trying to offend anyone. I think the truth speaks louder than word.
Traditional owners have told a Senate inquiry they feel ignored and disrespected in the approval process for offshore gas projects. They say there are currently 47 offshore leases in the Northern Territory, which have been granted without Indigenous input. Gas companies and energy producers have earlier told the inquiry they're seeking clarity around consultation requirements for offshore developments. Tiwi Elder Therese Woke Burke says the projects will negatively affect Indigenous communities.
We live on an island surrounded by the sea, and these gas projects are dangerous for our climate. We are already seeing the impact of climate change, with the water coming up further and quicker than it has in the past. There are only about 2,500 of us Tiwi people left in this world, and we want to live. Please don't do this to us and undo our hard work.
The Queensland Government is facing criticism over the high numbers of arrests of children and young people in the past year. Both Premier Stephen Miles and Police Minister Mark Ryan have recently praised the youth crime crackdown. But concerns have been repeatedly raised about the alarming proportion of Indigenous young people being incarcerated in Queensland, which has the highest rates of youth incarceration of any state in Australia. Queensland Green Michael Berkman says the focus should be on prevention, not prison.
Now, if the government was really interested in addressing this problem, they'd be spending more money on, you know, free meals at school. They'd be spending more on housing security, more on drug and alcohol supports for young people. Instead, they're spending all this money on 2 new youth prisons.
The federal government has unveiled a landmark funding agreement with the Northern Territory that says it will see its schools fully funded within 5 years. The funding is designed to bring each Territory student up to the schooling resource standard, which is the minimum funding required to meet educational needs. Education Minister Jason Clare says one in five children in the Territory are currently not receiving any funding. He says the funding needed for a public school student in the top end is almost double the national average because of the Territory's remote locations and large Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population.
We know that here in the Northern Territory, there are some of the most disadvantaged communities in the country and some of the most underfunded public schools in the country. Under the Gonski model, public schools here in the Northern Territory at the moment are funded at less than 80% of that original Gonski model. What we're announcing today is about fixing that.
The Albanese government says $4 billion in funding for Northern Territory housing shows its commitment to practical actions to improve the lives of First Nations people. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has announced the joint funding from federal and territory governments during a visit to the community of Binjari near Katherine. The decade-long commitment will see up to 270 homes built each year in remote Northern Territory communities, increasing the proportion of Indigenous people living in homes that are not overcrowded to almost 90% by 2031 is a target in the National Agreement on Closing the Gap. Mr. Albanese says the number of homes built may vary from year to year and that the funding accounts for inlation and local employment.
Many of them, of course, are in very remote communities, is what we're looking at. This community here is pretty close to Katherine, but some will be much more isolated. We'll be rolling out this housing, and with that comes additional costs. We accept that. So what we want to make sure isn't that it's underfunded. So this is an ambitious program, but it's the right program that's properly funded between the two levels of government.
The federal government has announced it will invest millions in Indigenous communities in Alice Springs and the Northern Territory. $23.5 million will be spent on improving the health outcomes of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, with $18.4 million to go to the Central Australian Aboriginal Congress to expand its children and youth assessment and treatment services. The Congress wants to increase the availability of early detection and intervention services for neurodevelopmental conditions, including fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and establish a health hub in Alice Springs. Senator Mulindiri McCarthy says the investment will have a significant effect.
We know that substantial investment into Alice Springs, into Central Australia around health, has been a critical part of everything that we're doing under the Albanese government. The $18.4 million that we've invested is contributing very much towards this facility that we're standing on here. And I'm incredibly pleased to see the work of all of the health practitioners involved with trying to improve the lives for First Nations people here in Central Australia.
A permanent memorial will be built in Darwin to honour the victims of Cyclone Tracy 50 years ago. The Australian government will give $600,000 to the Northern Territory government for a kinetic monument at Bundilla Beach, as well as a memorial designed by a local artist at East Point. 71 people died, more than 600 were injured, and 80% of the city was destroyed in the cyclone that hit the city in the early hours of Christmas morning in December 1974. More than 36,000 people left Darwin in its wake, while for those who stayed, the damage bill topped $800 million. New research has found Australia must do more to recognise the international qualifications of migrants to help address skills shortages. The report by the Committee of Economic Development of Australia shows the national needs to make more use of skilled migrants in the country. It recommends increasing their access to English language training and better recognising their qualifications and work experience obtained overseas. Catherine Scarth, the Chief Executive Officer of English language provider AIMS, says many skilled migrants may have high proficiency in one area of English and not so much in another.
Some of our experience has been, so with engineers particularly, that it's the type of written English that sometimes is the issue. So not necessarily oral skills, but some of the very kind of technical language skills. So it's probably thinking about how do we boost some of the more advanced English training for skilled migrants.
The federal government has cracked down on the net overseas migration in its overhaul of the system. The report also called for initiatives to tackle discrimination and prejudice to help improve employment outcomes for migrants. And to sport, the NBA season for Australian basketball export Ben Simmons is over. The 27-year-old guard is undergoing surgery but is expected to make a full recovery by autumn when his Brooklyn Nets side will hold its training camp. The three-time All-Star last played on February 26th. And that is NITV Radio's News Wrap of the Week.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Luana Grant, and you're listening to NITV Radio. Still to come on the show, NITV Radio chats to Wally Stewart from the New South Wales Aboriginal Fishing Rights Group about the landmark class action filed against the state of New South Wales on behalf of New South Wales South Coast native title claim holders who have been prosecuted for exercising their cultural fishing practices. We also share part two of Black Medicine's episode with Darug man Dr. Josh Tobin. But first, here are a few stories from our NITV news team. Torres Strait Islanders are calling on the federal and state governments to bolster border protection services. The Islanders say there's been an increase of drug trafficking, illegal fishing and people smuggling between Australia and Papua New Guinea. Saibai Island is just 4 kilometres from the Papua New Guinea mainland and has become a flashpoint for the border incursions. As Carly Wallace reports, some witnesses have asked to remain anonymous for fear of retaliation.
Saibai Island residents say these camps are illegal and the people who live here are from PNG. In January, a traumatising event unfolded when they confronted the visitors.
Pretty much attacked with machetes and spears and we were in fear for our safety and basically our life as well.
Residents say these unwanted arrivals are illegally fishing in their waters and it's having an impact.
We have a high number of Papuans literally exploiting our island.
Residents are concerned about the increase in the drug trade, theft and people smuggling. They say poverty in PNG is part of the problem.
You can understand and appreciate why people are coming across to Australia, come to Torres Strait, obviously because the grass is greener on outside. And one can't blame them because if it's for food, for your children and for your families and that, then you would do anything to do that.
Meanwhile, a $13 million high-tech security post on Saibai that was built in 2020 remains largely unmanned. NITV understands there are just 2 Torres Strait Islander liaison officers based in the facility, but they don't have the power to make arrests, carry a weapon or confiscate illegal items.
For years we've said to our enforcement agencies is that give us the proper compliance powers for our men and women who are frontline.
A spokesperson for Border Force says the facility is used during patrols, which occur several times a year. Border Force says it maintains a strong presence in the region, including maritime, air and land surveillance. But Torres Strait Islanders say it's not working.
We know it's happening, but there is very little that we can do to make something of it. I mean, if our agencies are understaffed, then for heaven's sake, we need to do something about giving them the proper manpower to be able to carry out those duties.
Warnings that our northern borders are under growing pressure. Carly Willis, NITV News.
For many of us, working out what we want to do with our lives and how to go about achieving it seems like an almost impossible task. That's particularly so for teenagers as they try to manage the pressures of growing up and the expectations of those around them. But a new book by Gamilaroi mother and son may go some way to helping. Titled Creating the Life of Your Dreams in Your Teens was launched yesterday at the Sydney Opera House to an audience of First Nations teens from across the state.
A motivational guide to unlock potential and achieve success is what you'll find between the pages of Kylie Kapton's latest book.
You know, there's so much in the book. It's all about well-being, it's about goal setting, careers, study hacks, you know, reaching out to people that can support you, and importantly, just dreaming big.
It's the third book the Gamilaroi author has written, but first with her son Tyrell.
Launching my third book, you know, that I've written with my son is pretty surreal, actually. Absolutely, yeah, overwhelmed with gratitude and super excited.
I was a bit nervous yesterday, but I'm very proud of both my mum and myself. Getting it done, and proud of what happened here today, every big turnout.
It was launched in front of over 100 First Nations students who also heard from a lineup of influential speakers.
Oh, I just hope that they just take away that, just the inspiration, knowing that they are smart, that they are deadly, that they are capable of doing everything, anything that they set their minds to.
And it's already receiving rave reviews by teens who had a chance to read it early.
Motivational, uplifting, reassuring, guiding and inspiring are just some of the things that I feel that this book is and can make you feel as well.
Create the Life of Your Dreams in Your Teen has been a guiding light in my journey. Its engaging stories and practical strategies have empowered me to back myself, dream big and take bold steps towards my aspirations.
Such an inspirational book for our generation now and for the future, as it teaches us the values of dreaming in life. Because everything is possible.
Giving teens the steps to reach their dreams. Ricky Kirby, NITV News.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. There has been a landmark class action filed against the state of New South Wales on behalf of New South Wales South Coast Native Title claim holders who have been prosecuted for exercising their cultural fishing practices. While Bunja elder Wally Stewart is from Naruma on the New South Wales South Coast and is a cultural fishing rights advocate and Nguyen man who joins NITV Radio to speak to the experiences of the Aboriginal fishers and community affected by the prosecution.
My name's Molly Stewart. I'm born and bred on the south coast in Naruma. I'm a Welbunja elder, and I'm a representative for the New South Wales Aboriginal Fishing Rights Group, and I'm also an applicant for the South Coast Native Title claim.
Now, there has been a landmark class action filed against the state of New South Wales by law firm JGA Sadler on behalf of New South Wales South Coast Native Title claim holders who have been prosecuted for exercising their cultural fishing practices. Can you talk to us a little bit about this as, you know, an elder and your role in the community?
Yeah, so down here on the south coast, we've been fighting for our fishing rights for probably 30, 40 years. And in the last 10 years, we set up a group called the New South Wales Aboriginal Fishing Rights Group. And we came together and started holding some protests and start standing up together, fighting for government, because the way we're treated down here on the south coast is, they've been locking our mob up for fishing and sending people to jail and really, hammering our mob. And, there's a law there that came out in 93 when Eddie Mabo won his native title case. So fisheries had to amend their Fisheries Management Act. All states had to amend their Fisheries Management Act in 93 to accommodate Section 211 of the Native Title Act, which means it gave Aboriginal people a right to hunt and gather and fish. But in New South Wales, fisheries choose to ignore that law, that Commonwealth law that sits on top of the state and police our mob with their state regulations. And New South Wales fisheries never ever implemented it, never ever came to law. So we lobbied in 2021. This culture fishing, and so we got an inquiry, and it came out again that they discriminated against their own law. So they basically discriminated against the Commonwealth Act, mm-hmm. that gave us the Native Title Act, Section 211, that gave us the right to fish, in 93, and then they also frauded Parliament in 2009 when they passed culture fishing and didn't implement it.
And what impact is this all having on, and, you know, will have on generations to come and throughout the community and for families, obviously, you know, the passing down of culture and knowledge and, you know, fishing on, you know, down on the South Coast, it's, you know, your way of life and, you know, providing food for, you know, your families. How is this impacting, you know, on the community?
So it's had massive impacts on our community. So like an example is that in the last 10 years, there's been engagements with appliance officers, fisheries appliance officers. They usually bring the police with them as well. And, you know, in engaging with Aboriginal people and you know, there's over 600 engagements just in the last 10 years down here. And in that engagement with fisheries, they choose to, like I said, they choose to ignore that Commonwealth law that gives us our right. And they would engage in it. So, when they were engaging with our appliance officers would, you know, charge our mob and still police us under their state regulations, which is a bag limit of two, you know, would go to court and then they would, you know, could end up with a fine or a warning or, you know, right down to sent to jail. So the damage they've done to our community, it reaped right through the community. For an example, like because we couldn't access that food, you know, abalone and lobsters and you know, our resources, it changed our diet and then people started to deteriorate. You know, so a lot of Aboriginal people down here on the South Coast, you know, from heart disease, diabetes and overweight because there was a fair amount of fishing and exercise in fishing. So there was no exercise and they were intimidated to go near the water because of every time we turned up there to go fishing or even, you know, just taking our kids out down to the water for a day on the beach. Fisheries would turn up there and embarrass us and, you know, search our cars and, you know, make it out there will be criminals and stuff like that. So, you know, it had a massive impact and it changed our diet and it sent people, even people were getting sent to jail. They were the breadwinners and they used to gather food for their families and also feed our elders and, so when they were going to jails, the family structure was breaking down and, you know, and then they were coming out of jail with mental health issues and, you know, so it was massive impact that it had on our community and, you know, because of them, we were too scared to hand that culture down to teach them our way of life. We nearly severed two generations of our culture fishermen because of the way they treated us.
Mm.
And, you know, so the impact of it goes not just the person who gets fined or goes to jail for the thing. It rippled right through the whole community. And the sad thing about it is, you know, at the same time they've done a lot of damage to our water. Like, you know, we go fishing and we might get 5 or 6 kilos of abalone, yet they allow the, you know, the abalone industry to take 100 ton a year, and they say it's sustainable. Our mob have seen them come right in close with their big boats and their air compressors and, you know, rip out 3 or 4 big bags of abalone. And you know, now we've got, a native title under claim in New South Wales and it's been registered since 2017. But that claim goes from south of Sydney all the way down to, you know, Victorian border. And, there's 450 kilometres of coastline in that. And our claim goes 3 nautical miles out to sea, but along the south coast, we've got sea urchin barons because they've got no competition with that abalone.
Mm.
And so they're just going in, and the sea urchins are just overtaking all our reefs and eating all the kelp, and it's just barren because you know we know it's climate change as well and global warming, but. You know, our mob will tell you when we've done that survey, they've seen all the divers coming in real close to the commercial guys and just ripping these abs out, even and dropping them out into deep water so our community couldn't get them because, like, we only dive, our community only jump off the rocks, you know, and dive. And, we, you know, we don't have their big air compressors and boats. So we've actually seen our reefs depleted, and we reckon, you know, 50% of our reefs along that 450 kilometres of coastline is damaged with sea urchin barrens.
Mm.
So, it's a massive impact. And when we were looking after this water forever until that fishing industry came along, we had a duty of care to maintain that. So when we fished, we made sure that water was, and then resources were still there and looked after that area. You know, and so that, even that passing down of culture, you know, that stopped. And that's like, we're sea people. We live on the south coast on the ocean. Our history shows that 80, 90% of our food source came from the estuaries and the ocean. And then all of a sudden, you know, this fisheries department comes along and sets up this industry and tells us that, no, we own them, you can't take them no more, and starts policing us. And you can obviously see what's happening there, but it's like a real protection racket going on in government to protect this, this abalone industry. And, you know, it's not hard to see. And but the point is with that is, they've done a lot of damage. They've just let them, you know, we don't believe it's sustainable anymore, what they're allowing them to take this 100 tonne.
I guess finally, like, where to from here and what, you know, do you and the community, like, where do you go from here? And especially, you know, with continuing to pass down culture, but, you know, all the things that you've just explained, where to from here for the community?
Well, you know, we're hoping that, the class action will, get over the line. And it's not about the compensation money or anything like that. It's about, making this government accountable. And, and we want to work together and build a future. Like, everybody's came here and make some money off our country except us. And we've been made out to be the criminals of our own country, our own waters and land. And we feel like it's happening again. When the abalone industry came along, we should have been part of that equation when they set up down here in the late 70s, early 80s. But we were left out of that equation. And now they've got a sea urchin industry and the Commonwealth is plowing $55 million over the next 5 years into this sea urchin industry. And they didn't even come and talk to us again about an industry. But for me, you know, we've trained an Aboriginal commercial dive team. And, you know, there is some good people in DPI that we work with, some scientists, and we're learning their science off them, and we've identified, you know, all our fishing sites that are damaged, and so we trained an Aboriginal scientific dive team to go and do some research on these abalone, and these sea urchin barrens, and see if we can fix them water up, because we would love to be able to get the government to throw some money into fixing up this water a bit, and us being able to be part of that, because that was our job. We were inherited, that right to look after country, and we haven't had a say in management. So, you know, out of this inquiry and with the native title, we can work together and have a say in management, how our country works, like in Queensland and Great Barrier Reef. And now they've got a great relationship with the communities up there, and they employ Aboriginal people to look after the country, and they have it worked together. There's nothing wrong with having a look at some of their models and bringing them down the south coast and solve some of these problems. Like, if we don't stand up and fight for our rights, our culture's gone forever. We've been doing this 40,000 years. The evidence is right along the coast, and if we just lay down and cop that, our way of life is destroyed forever. Like, we've even got courts, the judges bailing our people not to go near the water. Well, that's taken their culture away from them straight away. Now, over the years of all the evidence that we've gathered, we finally think that we have enough evidence to, bring out the truth, basically, where they discriminated against the Native Title Act. You know, and it was all at the expense of Aboriginal people who had to cop the worst end out of it. Mm. So it's damaged all our people along the south coast. Old people are missing out on a low in protein and iodine, and young people who are the breadwinners for them can't get that. So that's been identified. The mental health issues have been identified. And the sad thing about it is they throw, some other organisation has to pick it up. Like, they send them to jail. It costs money to keep people in jail. You know, our medical service has to pick up the heart disease, diabetes and overweight. You know, why fisheries just keep throwing all these resources out there to police us and make us look bad, make us look like criminals when they're allowed to take 100 tonne a year. You know, we're disappointed. and we know things could be better. And when we talk about closing the gap, I mean, it was only about 5 or 6 years ago that fisheries were probably the only department in New South Wales that didn't employ Aboriginal people. Or if they did, you could count them on one hand, wouldn't you? And then you look at all the other government departments in New South Wales, where, National Parks is a great example, where they've probably got, around 300 Aboriginal people employed, and they work with Aboriginal people. They've got handbacks, joint management, Indigenous land use agreements, and that's because they work together. But fisheries is just this little, money-making industry that don't want blackfellas anywhere near it. It's only changed in the last 10 few years because, Aboriginal people down here on the south coast have lobbied and, exposed them to some of the things they've been doing, to our people.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on to NITV Radio and having a chat to me about all of this. And, it's really sad what's happened and all the knock-on effects that you've spoken about too, just for the community. So hopefully we can catch up again and get a bit of an update on what's happening. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting to me today.
No problem. Thank you.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio. Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. Black Medicine is a health podcast hosted by Dr. Michaela Cooch, as she interviews First Nations healthcare professionals. Today, we share part two of Black Medicine's episode with Darug man Dr. Josh Tobin.
We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land where this podcast episode was produced. SBS pays our respects to the traditional owners, the Cammeraygal people of the Guringai Nation, and their elders past and present. We would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners from all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lands you are listening from today.
Jingiwala, welcome to Black Medicine, a podcast about First Nations health by First Nations people. I'm your host, Dr. Michaela Cooch, a proud Bundjalung woman, Indigenous doctor and health expert. Today we are talking to an amazing doctor, educator and aspiring anaesthesiologist, Dr. Josh Tobin. So excited to have you here. If someone was like you and was thinking about becoming a teacher, how would you get into that role? Because I know a lot of mob doctors who are fantastic and have the ability to be education leaders, but it's a bit hard to be like, how do you get in? I don't know how you get into the university space.
Yeah, I mean, as you were saying, finding a university is probably going to be your best start, obviously, if your hospital's affiliated one or if your practice is. I started off early med school, end of med school. I started teaching anatomy to the junior students.
Oh.
That was really good. Built it up from there. Intern as resident, I basically took medical students to the bedside and said, this is a respiratory exam, this is a pediatric exam. So, like, getting those skills of learning how to teach properly, because it's hard. I don't think we don't get taught how to teach in medical school, even as becoming a doctor. And so I continued that. And then I was also incredibly blessed the fact that worked with Macquarie University. My family's worked with Macquarie University for a long time with the sculptures and paintings and everything like that. It just came up. And I'm part of the Aboriginal Advisory Board as well there. So it was just kind of like the beautiful meeting of like a lifelong passion for teaching throughout my career. And then a job happened to pop up. But Macquarie University is also affiliated with Royal North Shore. So it was just this kind of like tying together of everything kind of just fit together perfectly. So, yeah, that's how I ended up. It was basically did a lot of pre-teaching and teaching throughout medical school and internship and residency and everything like that. And then just something managed to perfectly popped up in a subject I was interested in. So I think it was just stars aligning. I think just approaching your local, like the university that you're closest to geographically helps. And for me, it was massive. The fact that I could teach on my country, that blew me away. I was like, excellent. Like, my first ever lecture was on country. And I was like, this rocks. This is awesome.
It's so interesting, the circle of life.
And when you go back to country and you get to work and showcase your skills on country, there's just this essence of like pure happiness and joy that you can't explain to anyone. And you feel like the ancestors have made you want to be there. Everything that they put into their work and life has brought you to this place. And like it feels like home, like nothing else feels like it.
Yeah. I come from a ancestry of clever men. So the idea that I'm continuing on that from what my ancestors did of like years and years and years ago is just, it's rewarding is I think a bit of an understatement for that type of statement.
I understand it's so hard to explain that feeling. I remember on my 30th birthday, I was delivering babies at the hospital that I was born in. And I was like, just so in shock. Like the whole day, I couldn't feel like it was real. And I was like, I feel like I was put on this earth for this reason. And in my place of birth, I'm back here. Yeah. It was so bizarre. So now, could we talk about your journey in medicine, if that's okay? I'd love to hear about your junior years and how you found them. And then also about what you did in your early years to then go into your registrar years.
Yeah, sure. I'm pretty positive about most of this stuff because it was a lot of hard work, but I love medicines and I love it. So it was I started my internship at Royal North Shore. I did my internship and residency at Royal North Shore. I did the classics of surgery and medicine, lots of general medicine terms. And then I got to do an ED term at Royal North Shore, which is a big trauma center. So lots of sick people coming in from all around New South Wales. So even though I was quite junior as an intern, I got to be part of the resuscitations, if only just doing some simple stuff, the big resuscitations that would occur from all around New South Wales. So just like amputations or burns or big traumas, car crashes and everything like that. They would be helicoptered in to Royal North Shore. And then we would start resuscitating and working. So that was just very instrumental. I was like, oh, this is cool. Like this is very like full on, but this is the critical care side of medicine that I had a huge passion for. So then my resident year, the next year, I did two terms of ICU, which were great. I got to work in Royal North Shore, the big ICU up the top, four pods, incredible stuff, like just in terms of like really, really amazing interventions that they can do. So putting people on cardiac bypass, putting like intubating people and all this really interesting stuff. And just kind of if people on their worst day, we could, and the sickest patients that you could have that, we were treating them. So that was incredible. And then I went up for a couple of weeks to a term up at Port Macquarie ICU, which was good, a regional hospital, smaller than RNS, but still, you still get some crazy stuff because it was a trauma center. We did have traumas. And then I also got to do, which was probably my hardest term in terms of hours and the amount of work I did, but I did burns and plastics and reconstructive surgery, a term at Royal North Shore, which was all the big burns, like 80% burns to 10% burns, came through the doors of RNS. They'd be chopped in or shipped in or whatever would happen. And I'd be part of the treating team, the people that saw them in the emergency department and cut the skin to make sure it was like breathing and stuff, like, make sure it was not constricting. Yeah, it's just some crazy stuff. So that all basically culminated that whole year of doing ICU. And I actually got to do pediatric ED as well, which was incredible. So all of that culminated. And I was like, critical care is exactly what I want to do. So emergency anesthetics and ICU is like the critical care thing. So I got a job in Port Macquarie doing 4 months anesthetics, 4 months ED and 4 months ICU, which was awesome. It was 4 months of anesthetics. I was like, excellent. I love this. Intubating. For people who don't know, it's anesthetics is just, I believe you've had anesthetists on the past before, but it's intubating. It's taking care of people while they're undergoing surgery, also to do with pain and the preoperative assessment beforehand. So that was amazing. I fell in love with that. And then at the very end of the year, only a couple of months ago, I finished up at the ICU there. So I did an ICU term there as the kind of like overnight and during the day, like as the registrar, like on the registrar's roster. And it was incredible. It was just like the kind of like a really stepping up. I'm sure you probably have the same feeling of like stepping up as a senior, like as just a little bit of a step up because I'm relatively junior and all of this is with consultant oversight. But having that kind of boss on a phone call or something like that. I mean, you must have the same feeling when you had those big steps as a registrar. so it's amazing, personally, yeah.
Yeah, it's so lovely when you find your niche and your area of work that you live, breathe, feel, and just bloody enjoy every moment of it. And that's what makes medicine amazing. Like, I think it's really hard to explain the feeling of caring for someone and then seeing their progress over time and know that you've been able to help them in some way. And I guess, one, when you have the ability to do that, but then also have the ability to do that for MOB and represent MOB and be open to teaching others about care for MOB, there's like so many layers that are just so amazing. I think that you also really highlighted some really important facts that are, if you work hard and choose your pathway, you will achieve your dreams. And you've done that with your dedication, your time, but also to the fact that you are working above and beyond the level of a doctor, not only in your education role, but advocacy role. Like, there's so many great positive things about you. So I really appreciate that and you coming on the show today.
Cheers.
I honestly think that you are such a humble person. I bet not many people say how amazing you are, but if you put it on paper and just speaking to you, you're bloody awesome.
Join the conversation on radio, online, and mobile. You're with NITV Radio. Join the conversation on radio, online, and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
And that's all we have time for on today's program. You can listen back to the show anytime online or catch any of our stories on our website. NITV Radio will be back next week with more stories from right across the country. I'm your host, Luana Grant. Thanks so much for listening and have a great weekend.
To reset. Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.